We're not starting where Kant did. We're starting with sovereignty and collective security, which seemed to be, for the UN community, a more logical place to start. And we'll get to the others as the day unfolds. We do plan to cover all three areas. As your note with our commentators for each session, we've tried to combine a leading academic with a leading practitioner. But as you see with this panel, and I think with others, sometimes it's hard to tell who's the practitioner and who is the academic. I've been accused of some confusion on this subject myself. We do find that this is where sometimes theory and practice meet, and that's something that IPI can be useful on. So with sovereignty and collective security, a lot of very big questions. Some of them are laid out in your program. We have two terrific speakers to lead off. I've asked them both to talk about 10, 15 minutes max each to have plenty of time for discussion. We'll begin with my longtime colleague from Columbia, Bob Jervis, who is a very distinguished theoretician, political scientist, but also one who is very well grounded in the world of practice. He's someone who's, I think you'll find out, very pragmatic, very sensible. And his most recent book, Why Intelligence Fails, Lessons from the Iranian Revolution and the Iraq War, I think will give you some sense of this. He is a past president of the American Political Science Association, and we're just delighted, Bob, to have you with us. So if you can share your wisdom for the next 10 or 15 minutes, and I'm sure it'll be a little bit provocative to get the conversation started.
Thank you. Very glad to be here. And since part Ed and one of my former students, I think, had a hand in inviting me, I will try to be provocative because I'm skeptical of at least some of the arguments of Kant and some of some trends that we've had. I'm certainly not going to talk about the ideas of Immanuel Kant, not with this audience. I am going to talk briefly about, first, some introductory remarks. Then I'm going to talk a little about collective security, which I don't think is the era we're in. Again, also briefly in praise of sovereignty, because I think it's a little too easy and too quick to dismiss sovereignty as a force for peace. And mostly talk about what I think is almost a modern miracle, which partly fits with Kant, but I think through partly different route, and that is the establishment of what political scientists call a security community in the developed world. And that will probably take, if I have more time, I got a couple of other topics, but I probably won't. I agree with the minister at first that the, at least among the most pressing problems are the ones we think of, let's say, human security rather than state security, problems from weak states rather than strong states, and indeed from forces of nature that we as humans partly have created. That is climate change. We sit here, we're going to be high enough to be above a 15-foot rise in sea level, but I think we're going to have trouble leaving the building if that happens. So I think those are real problems. But I want to just have you keep in mind two different, at least, questions. One is a limitation that we all, both scholars and decision makers, face in our ability to foresee the future. And that I turn to another famous philosopher, Yogi Berra, known especially in this country, who said prediction is difficult, especially about the future. And obviously that was true for Kant, to say he both published and perished. That is, that, you know, his he had a vision for the future that at least in the short run was totally untrue. And I think we do the best to foresee the future, and often our predictions actually affect the way we behave, sometimes for better, as I'll mention, sometimes for worse. Should realize that if one were holding a conference, we wouldn't say it, 1800, the future would look incredibly bleak. If one were, and yet after the very bloody Napoleonic Wars, right, the 19th century, at least for the Europeans, they were good years. They were very good years. If we held a conference in 1900, things would look very good. We don't have to finish that story. So there are, I am in some ways do see grounds for a great deal of optimism, but we must realize that we've been fooled for forces, technical, political, forces in human nature, forces in ideas that we probably can't foresee and really have great trouble understanding. Second point, sort of just general perspective, if you will, is if it is true, which I think is, well, is it true really that the problems are what the minister said in his keynote points? I think yes and no. I agree with all the dangers he listed, but I want to make two qualifying remarks. One is that there are real threats to security in the traditional sense. The American government argues there are real threats from military security, from, for instance, not only states that harbor terrorists, which are not necessarily failed states. Afghanistan, before we failed it, was not a failed state. But there are real threats, the U.S. argues, from North Korea and Iran, and perhaps from Syria. It's debatable, not crazy. And other states, I wouldn't mention them, would see threats from the U.S. to their security. That's an argument I'm quite happy to make. So there are really very, very large threats, traditional threats. And those threats will endanger many more lives than the others. We've got to keep that in mind, that large-scale wars are still not impossible, and they do incredible amounts of destruction, even without nuclear weapons. Furthermore, we are now, I think, focused to a considerable extent on the sorts of threats that the minister listed because of a receding of traditional threats, and that's what I want to come to. First, let me say just a little on collective security. I think in some way this may be something we're not going to see for a long time. Collective security, at least in the international politics literature, and I think in the international law literature, means a commitment to come to the aid of those who are attacked, irrespective of any other calculation of interest. I don't think we've ever seen collective security. I don't think the youngest person in this room, certainly not me, will live to see that. I think that degree of abnegation is simply beyond reach. States are not going to do that. They're going to calculate their interests. Now, they don't necessarily calculate it in a narrow, short-run way. But I think the idea that states will always band together to prevent violations of human rights or aggression, irrespective of how they think the behavior may affect them in the immediate term, is not going to happen, and I don't think we should think it will happen. Technically, NATO is a collective security agreement. But, of course, it never was, right? We know that. The purpose, Ismay, the British soldier and diplomat, had it right. The purpose of NATO was to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in. And it's still the main purpose of NATO, although it's partly in some formations, to keep the Americans down as well. A goal, by the way, I applaud. NATO, even NATO, is really not a collective security agreement. Indeed, I'm not sure you'd want a collective security agreement if you'd have it, because if that sort of guarantee were given to all states, there is the problem that the economists, political economists, note as the moral hazard. States can cause a trouble in various ways, short of war, and they can be provocative because they're protected. There were arguments, quite legitimate, against including the Baltic republics in NATO on the grounds that a security guarantee against Russia might encourage them to behave inappropriately against their Russian minorities. That's not a crazy argument. Okay, so we don't have collective security. and we're not going to. That doesn't mean we don't have peace. And the I want to make two points here. First, a little on sovereignty and peace, and then mostly on the security community. That I know many of my friends and former students in the NGO world and other of my liberal friends, both domestically and foreign, think that sovereignty is by and large the enemy of peace, and think that we not only, as the minister said, and here I agree, that at certain points sovereignty and certainly human rights come in contradiction and conflict and face hard choices, but that we will get a more peaceful and better world as we diminish the power of states and increase the power of various transnational forces. I am, that may be, creating a straw person, but I do think at bottom this is the view of a great many proponents of especially human rights organizations and others. And I'm skeptical, partly for reasons that Kant realized, that when I think about peace and war, I think about costs and benefits. I'll come back to that in the security community. And I think states usually are acutely sensitive to costs and benefits. They sometimes often get it wrong. We know all those cases, the Athenian Assembly and the Sicilian expedition is one of the obvious ones, Michael mentioned, but that they do have a form of responsibility. And I think that sovereignty, in a way, first means, of course, you do not get as much failed states, and that it's only states rather than transnational groups that can form the sort of pacts that Kant talked about and that I'll talk about, implicit pacts, in a minute. So I think that I'm not at all sure the world will see continuing erosions of sovereignty, and I'm not at all sure that a reduced sovereignty would make a better world. With that, I want to move to what really I think is, I know it sounds a sort of false exaggeration, but I think it isn't. Almost the miracle of the late 20th and 21st century, and something that we all take for granted, although people around this table may take it for granted a little less than certainly my students do, and that is the existence of the security community, which I'll define in 1 minute, among a set of states, largely those we call the leading states, well, the developed states, the states of North America, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Europe, up till at least the border with Russia, I think, no. Further, this, of course, is a core, is the North America and the EU, but extends more broadly. These countries form a security community. This is not any legal concept. What this idea means, and a concept developed by Karl Deutsch in conjunction with a set of academics and practitioners in the about 50 years ago, is these would be a set of countries that, although they have not amalgamated and formed any unit, not only are they not fighting each other, but they really have taken themselves out of the state of war in the sense of Kant and Hobbes. That is, war among them is literally unthinkable. And when I say that, I mean just that if we broke into the safes of all the defense ministries of these countries, or more likely now just hacked into their secret websites, we would not find defense war plans for war among them. And any of you who know a lot of history or have worked in defense establishments know that's a really strong statement. What most defense establishments do, They don't, usually don't fight. They have to do something. What do? They write war plans. And war plans for the wildest things, partly because you can't be sure about the future, and that's the way you keep your game up. So to say there are no war plans for these countries is really a very, very strong statement. Indeed, I think it's not an exaggeration to say that the driver of international politics throughout history has been war and thinking about war among the most powerful states in the world. And we're now in a situation where that is no longer true. This is nothing short of a miracle. I mean, the lives saved. Look at European history. Michael mentioned briefly the wars of the 18th century. Even though the 19th century was pretty peaceful once the Napoleonic War is over, it's not completely peaceful. That if we're in a world where the leading powers don't even think about fighting each other, that is an incredible change. It seems to me this is partly related to factors that Kant was concerned with, and not completely. Let me mention what they are, and then the question, of course, of whether that can last and how the security community might be expanded. There are various arguments about why this has come about. Certainly, the history is important, the experience of World War II and the experience of a perceived common enemy in the Soviet Union. Now, Europe, I think, would not have united without both of those and the American security guarantees and the American pressure on Europe to unite. So it is very much historically determined. It is partly bitter experience with how costly war is. It partly is, and here I think Kant is right, a development of cosmopolitan values, of shared values. These states in the security community are very different. You know, they're on a great many dimensions, and they differ, have important differences in values. And yet they do share more than was true in many cases in the past, but sharing isn't enough. The Europeans of the 18th and 19th and 17th centuries shared tremendous values. One of those values was war was good, and states should aggrandize themselves, and pursuits of honor and glory was central to the human endeavor. So you can have shared values in a bellicose world. We've lost that. War is now seen as something, a last resort, rather than something, I mean, it's honorable that we honor the profession of the soldiers, but war itself, in a sense, is not honorable. It is something that one is forced to do. So that value of discrediting war is, I think, crucial. But remember Yogi Berra, is this irreversible? I'd like to think so. I'm not positive. The other pillar in which this rests, again, related to Kant and related to broadly the liberal theory of peace, is, of course, the benefits of trade and investment. You look at U.S.-China relations. China is not in the security community. A war with China is certainly not unthinkable. I don't think it will happen, but, you know, there's a significant chance it will within the next 50 years, no question about that. Anyway, but one, I think, pacifying factor is the economic interdependence. I notice our pens are made in China. We can't get along without them. We couldn't.
They also don't work very well.
Oh, it's going to get us in trouble. And the third factor, because I am, as usual, overrunning my welcome, though, is the enormous costs of war. I think that we were slow, the community, to see the value of that. That nuclear weapons, not only the bloody nature of World War I was important, but didn't do the trick. The bloody nature of World War II helped, and nuclear weapons help enormously. Everyone knows that if there is a war among leading countries, very great chance nuclear weapons would be used, and just incredible destruction. So it is the very costs of war that I think do help keep the peace. What are the prospects for expanding the security community? I'm glad I'm out of time because I'm really not sure. from my standpoint, which is less looking at civil strife and human rights violations and more at the big ticket items, that is the possibility of wars involving Russia and China, the obviously most important question is, can Russia and China be brought into the security community? This depends partly on economic relations. It depends partly on values, which I think at this level are shared. But it also depends on good old standard diplomacy in solving a number of diplomatic frictions, which are very real and do not go away. But I think at minimum, just to close, the existence of the security community is very important. So we take it for granted. I ask my I teach the introductory undergraduate course. I ask my students how many of them think there might be a war, you know, between Germany and France, or think that the U.S. might get in a war with any of these countries. And, you know, they look at me as though I'm crazy. Well, they do that for a number of reasons. But, you know, that thought has literally never crossed their minds. And it, I assume, for you people has crossed your minds, but it really is worth thinking more about, not only because it's something to treasure and because it maybe does not maintain itself. Maybe if we take it for granted, we could lose it. And there may be lessons in it for how the security community can be expanded. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Bob. And thank you for fulfilling my prediction that it would be hard to tell the academics from the practitioners. So I guess we've just heard from the woolly-minded theorist, and now we'll go on to the hard-headed practitioner. The only thing I think you said that I think might be worth some consideration at some point, if China and Russia are not part of the security community, there are two of the four co-conveners of the San Francisco Founding Conference and two of the five permanent members of the Security Council. So the security community and Security Council are not congruent, which I think is a very interesting concept for all of us who work around the Security Council and around the UN. But thank you for a very stimulating beginning. Now we'll continue that tradition with stimulating conversation, I'm sure. Pedro Serrano is the acting head of the European Union delegation here in New York. He has a long career as a Spanish diplomat, among other things, among the representatives both in New York at the UN at an earlier point and to the EU. He's a very, as you'll find out, a very articulate commentator and always has interesting things to say. I don't know whether he has an academic hat, but I think probably by the end of his presentation we should give him one. But terrific to have you here, Pedro, and we look forward to your comments.
Thank you very much, Edward. It's a real pleasure to be here and actually to run away from the most immediate concerns that we're all suffering in the buildings on the other side of the street and to go into more elevated position in discussion. Since I am a practitioner, I think I have to start by saying that whatever I say it certainly cannot be held against my organization, against the European Union. This only affects whatever I say. It's my own personal responsibility, and I hope it will not impact negatively on any image you may have on the European Union. I think, and very interested by the subject that you brought forward, and I think the first reflection I had when I looked at this is, yes, of course, this was Kant, and it was the 18th century. Of course, Kant was wonderful, and he had a vision that carried over centuries, and we're still building on what he said and thought. But certainly when we look at security today and when we talk about collective security, and I think Professor Jervis was very clear in saying it, do we have any collective security mechanisms really worthy of the name? And has this worked in the past? And certainly our approach is in the European Union is that security is certainly not a military issue. This is no longer about borders. It has become a very complex concept. I imagine this was what the minister said earlier, and I'm sorry I couldn't be here to listen to him, and I'm sorry if I repeat things, but certainly conflict is an element in security, but so is development, so is climate change and the stress it can produce on resources, on movements, our population, certainly weapons of mass destruction, organized crime, terrorism, the impact of fragile states. So we are developing, we have developed, I think, a much more complex concept of security. And actually, when you take all those elements into account, you realize that even if you're sitting comfortably in Munich or somewhere else, where something that happens down in Guinea-Bissau will have an impact on your security at some point, and something that happens in any other part of the world will have an impact. And if we do not deal with climate change, it will have an impact on you sitting watching TV in Munich or in Paris or elsewhere. And this actually leads us to another way of dealing with security, because we realize that actually there's total interdependence now in the world sphere, and that countries cannot just ignore something that is happening very far away. And therefore, security changes into the not rules-based security, which doesn't work, not a threat-based security, which doesn't work either, and actually has led to wars, and collective security mechanisms have sparked wars. It leads to a concept of security based on the identification of common interests. And this is the story of Europe as well. I think we've had most warring, or among the most warring histories in history, and we have come to and put this to an end through development of common interests, not through collective security mechanisms, or although of course NATO has played an important role, but certainly working together and finding that we have much more interest in working together than fighting each other. And of course, this afterwards has to be translated into legal obligations, and it has a moral background, but it is essentially about identification of these common interests. And the world of today, the globalized world, shows that this interdependence means that we all have common interest. All of the 192 countries that sit across the road have common interest. And if we're moving towards then this development of a world where we have to work in solidarity, obviously, this has an impact on our sovereignty. And the absolute sovereignty of states, which is very well defended also next door very often, is in constant conflict with this idea of finding these common interests and working into creating a world that's built on solidarity. And we're doing this on a constant daily basis, be it on operational issues. And these operational issues can range from development programs to crisis management operations, and whether this country should be examined or not, and not because it's an internal issue, whatever, all these kind of arguments. And there we see sovereignty at stake. It also plays in the more philosophical nature of our discussions next door, because it is true that on the basis of this, we're working to the development of common values. Common values based on the identification of common interests. I think it would be very difficult to identify those common values if we didn't have the common interests, because, well, I don't think, despite what many philosophers say that we're essentially a moral animal, and so we are moved, unfortunately, more by our interests very often than by our moral values. And therefore, if we look at the UN, and this is very much, I can say so now, the EU perspective, the UN is a sort of a, I think we could call it a very big collective universal security system, but not in the traditional sense of the word, in a much more larger sense, with this larger sense of security. But can the UN do this on its own? The answer is clearly not. And even looking at a narrower sense of what security is, we look at Chapter 8, for example, in the Charter, which has always been very interesting to me, with these regional arrangements and how we're going to implement. I don't really know whether a lot of us feel really identified with what Chapter 8 means. Certainly the European Union does not, although we operate with Chapter 8. This means in any case that it is an acknowledgement that if we want to solve problems, it's fine to try to solve them at a global scale, but very often we can find better solutions at a regional level. Now, this can be done through collective security instruments or elements of collective security. It can essentially be done through the development of links, trade links, cultural links among states. And we're seeing the development of this process throughout the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st century. Out of curiosity, out of the little time I had, I tried nevertheless to look, you know, what kind of really security instruments we have in these different regions. And actually, I have to say that nothing extremely well developed. Maybe where you have more collective type of security instruments, I would say, is Europe. We can talk about NATO. We can talk about the OSCE. I don't know if I should put the Council of Europe in that context. It would be a far-fetched effort. I would certainly put the EU, but I will talk about this at a later stage. And Africa, actually, Africa has a good record on what it's trying to do, with a big, important effort in developing the African Union, but also very powerful sub-regional organizations, be it ECOWAS, SADC, I mean, many in the Eastern Africa community, so IGAD, which is active. And so there are many different efforts in Africa, certainly. Then, my ignorance, but I have distinguished colleagues here from Latin America, which may want to who may want to address how this issue is dealt with in Latin America. And there, I know there are important, certainly, integration efforts, and CARICOM is certainly one of, it's a very developed one, but there are others as well, and Mercosur and other efforts within Latin American continent to bring interests together. And of course, we have the big project now of a Latin America, again, a new organization. And there are elements of security in many of these projects, certainly in the OAS charter. You have elements of, which strangely enough, when I read it very quickly, it sounded as it was a bit of an extension of the Monroe Doctrine. Essentially, it's we will fight against those that attack us. Okay. There was also some elements about, and I don't think anyone is thinking about attacking the Latin American continent, but and or the American continent, because, well, okay. And then we move to Asia. My feeling is that in Asia, but I'm again very ignorant, but I'd be very interested in knowing more from those around the room that are more familiar with this. There are less developed structures in terms of security. Yes, we have new ones that are being developed in the wake of the USSR's disappearance, and we have the CIS, and we have the Shanghai Agreement. We have ASEAN, of course, which is an important effort within Asia. But how well articulated is it? I have some questions. So clearly, there is an interest in looking at what we can do regionally, and there's an interest at what we can do regionally to satisfy the concerns for security. But I would say even more to see how we can develop regional integration processes. And this is what, if I may make some publicity for my own master's, this is what the European Union is about, and this is the success of the European Union. Actually, when it is created in 1957, we're not talking about the political dimension. We're not talking certainly about a security dimension. We're talking about a common market. We're talking about the movements of people and capitals and goods. And on this, actually, we've built, I would say, one of the most, we can be criticized. And I'm very happy to be critical about the EU, and so don't take this as that we think we're the best. We're not, but okay, we've managed to get past the horrible centuries of war. And if we look at how Europe is evolving now, the European Union as such, without any collective security mechanism stricto sensu, although we do have a clause also in our treaties now that require collective defense, but anyhow, that's not the key issue. That's, it is a pole of security in Europe. And if we're moving towards a greater stabilization in the Balkans, it's because there's a perspective of European integration. And this applies to other parts of the European continent as well. So the creation, development of these common interests is a powerful motor towards security. And actually, the European Union tries to encourage this also in its partnership with other regions, and even encourages the development of common markets through its the Economic Partnership Agreements, that it is fostering worldwide. Now, just a short word. You had also the sovereignty in Europe. Well, obviously, the European Union is par excellence one of the organizations where more supranational powers have been granted to the organization itself. And I will just refer very briefly to the latest move in the Lisbon Treaty, where a real, Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the European Union is coming to light, the External Action Service, with embassies abroad. So the building on these common interests we have built, we're building, actually, I hope there are no British around the table, that we're building a political union, a political union that has a security dimension. Strangely enough, the security dimension, it's not for collective security inside the union, it's in order to assist, basically, the UN in stabilizing and in state building and peace building abroad. Finally, just one word, because I'm sure I've also gone beyond my time. the role of non-state actors. And here I will just share with you my ignorance and my perplexity. I think we are all looking at state actors because we're familiar with what they are. And we think we know what they are. I'm not sure we know what they are, but we think we do. Now, I have very often the feeling that I live in a sort of a superficial epidermic world, the world of diplomacy, where we handle all kinds of issues, and but we remain at the surface. What are the real forces that are moving our societies? And these real forces, we all know, go beyond borders and beyond states. When you look at you look at, for example, the money the BP spent in repairing the damages of the spill in the Gulf of Mexico, which is billions and billions of dollars. You know, how much money of that type can we mobilize in terms of AOD, for example? Not very much, I'm afraid, nor in our overall effort in cooperating. So there are very important actors out there which are not under state control, which have their own dynamics, and which, yes, work in frameworks created by states, that cooperate amongst themselves. But very often I have the feeling that we're, or at least, and certainly after what I've said, you will certainly think I'm only scratching the surface and remaining at an epidermic level most of the time, but that we are working very often at an epidermic level, that there are realities underground that for whatever reasons we do not analyze sometimes sufficiently when we're dealing with international conflicts and issues. At the beginning, when I saw the reference to the non-state actors, I thought, well, they might be thinking about guerrillas and things of that kind. I think when we look at non-state actors, we have to have a much broader sense in any case of what we're doing. You can put in the business community, financial centers, religious groups of different kinds. And how does the state deal with this? I think in the 18th century, we had a more patrimonial sense of the state, if I can still call it so. We developed a sort of a national, which is a more dangerous and ambiguous concept in the 19th century. Where are we now? And what are our states? And what is the sovereignty? And what is the control? What does sovereignty apply to? So expressing my perplexity of these things and hoping to hear from you. And once again, very glad to have been invited to say a few words. Thank you.
Thank you, Pedro. That was excellent. It's very helpful, and thank you for bringing in the regional piece, which we sort of thought you might, and also bringing in the question of the non-state actors, two pieces which I think are very important parts of the puzzle. We have about 45 minutes for conversation. We have a lot of talent around the table from different walks of life. If I might make one or two very quick comments, just because they're a little hard to resist, to open the discussion. One, particularly with the minister's remarks, but it's come up a couple times here, human security versus state security. To me, it's hard to have human security without state security. And I think a lot of the kinds of threats he was talking about is where you don't have state security, and you have other actors acting in unhelpful ways. And yes, you can have state security and repression, but over the long term, it seems to me these are not antithetical concepts. In fact, they tend to go together, state security and human security. Second, I wasn't going to say anything about the responsibility to protect, which is, of course, what I do for Secretary General, but several people have raised it, so I feel a slight obligation to make a couple comments about it. One, I again don't think that responsibility to protect is at all antithetical with the idea of sovereignty. I think, in fact, sovereignty properly understood is very important for the deliverance of these kinds of responsibilities and protection and the prevention of these kinds of crimes. And the minister did say, and I think I do need to respond to this, because it is also said in the Obama's U.S. national security strategy, which is somehow when the state fails to offer protection, that then it cedes these responsibilities to the international community. That's certainly not the view of the Secretary General. States maintain that responsibility. They may not exercise it properly, but they maintain the responsibility for protection of populations on their territory. The international community may help. The international community may have to intervene. But the state doesn't simply give up that responsibility. That is retained. So I think it's important to recognize that. Also, I'm glad you raised, Pedro, the question of non-state actors. because when you think of the kinds of lists of crimes and things that the minister was speaking about, clearly armed groups have to have responsibilities for protections of populations as well, whether it's the LRA or the RUF or one group or another. There's lots of history, unfortunately, of those kinds of armed groups creating those kinds of crimes, as we've seen too often. Finally, there's some emphasis, I think, in Kant about the like-minded coming together to form these kinds of leagues. And it seems to me one of the values of the UN over time is that it hasn't been just the like-minded. That, in fact, this continuing discourse among countries with sometimes quite different security interests and perceptions is one of the great values of the organization. And we often lament when you can't get agreement because we'd like to see consensus in everything. But I think over time, historically, the value has often been to bring in for conversation countries that have very, very different kinds of views. Finally, in that regard, the assumption that somehow Republican states or Democratic states or others are going to have very similar interests, I think, frankly, doesn't hold up historically, even in very recent history. The assumption is if a state is Republican, if it's relatively Democratic, if it's relatively representative, it will be looking to the interests, sometimes the narrow interests of its people, not necessarily identifying with the broader international interests all the time. And I think that's one of the reasons why some big states we can think of that are highly Democratic are also highly problematic in dealing in a consensus-based institution like the UN so often. So those who talked about values as being key seems to me really does get to the point. Having transnational values that are internalized domestically, which then shape the way countries think about their interests, rather than denying the validity of those interests. Anyway, those are just a couple of comments I couldn't resist. But we've got a good 40, 45 minutes. I think if people put up their name cards, it's easier to see, particularly if you face it in my direction. My peripheral vision is not too bad, but this is a fairly long table, so particularly people on this side who would like to take the floor, I hope they will put up their placards. So I don't know who would like to begin. And we do have a microphone for anyone in the back who'd like to comment as well. If you don't have a placard, then make some kind of noise or wave. So who'd like to begin? We have so much talent around the table, I can't imagine everyone's going to be shy. A lot has been said, but not everything has been said. And a lot of what has been said, I think, is quite challengeable, including the few comments I just made. I'm afraid this is one of these crowds that all of a sudden, when there's 5 minutes to go, everyone will want to speak. Please, Francesco.
Well, I think that since the talented are shy, I would probably start. I just want to say a word on the European Union experience, and I think what is one of the most interesting questions for me on collective systems in general is how much of the European experience can be translated into other continents, in other parts of the world. I totally agree with Professor Jervis. It's extraordinary what happened in the last 70 years of Europe. Is there some elements that tell us that similar experience can be translated into Africa, for example? Africa has been mentioned, has been developing quite extraordinarily in terms of normative and institutional developments in the recent years. At the same time, conflict is still very alive. In 2009, one out of three conflicts were still in Africa. On the other hand, the Middle East, where cooperation interstate is not that strong, also have seen conflict quite active. Some point of history, almost 25% of the conflict in the world, in average roughly 14-15%. On the other hand, we have Asia, where I also not particularly expert of that part of the world, but it seems to me that in sort of a collective and security community institutions are rather weak. At the same time, the region has been, relatively speaking, quite peaceful. So I don't see a strong correlation in some part of the world between a development of institutions and normative and sort of internal regional, at least, normative development and peace necessarily. but there is some sort of correlation in Europe. And to me, it seems interesting to understand what kind of elements that European history have seen and experienced can be translated to these other continents. We talked about values. We talked about democracy, so basically systems, domestic systems. Is any of these as a strong role, or a stronger role? It seems to me very hard to develop one single sort of robust and parsimony theory of global peace throughout the world, since that to me that every continent, at least every region of the world, has a sort of a different approach and different understanding. But it remains the question if we can see an Africa in the future or an Asia to be more prone to peace due to a development of institutions and norms as Europe did.
Thank you. Apparently you've been provocative. I see our representative of Brazil here in Shep form and then Ambassador Zinsa.
There's been some ambiguity in relation to three very closely interrelated concepts, and I'd just like to see them explored more fully in the discussion. And it's the relationship between sovereignty, the notion of state responsibility and how that is acquired and exercised, and the role of national and international non-state actors or social movements in promoting and to some extent assuring that responsibility, and the degree to which those are viewed as interdependent as opposed to antithetical, that is, social movements eroding state sovereignty, as Professor Jervis, I think, suggested at one point. It seems to me needs further exploration and deepening in the discussion. There's one other question I'd like to put on the table, because the again, this notion that somehow democracy assures peace. And when we look at the history, including the recent history of warfare in Europe, which is hardly over, as I think you were suggesting, it seems to me that there has been the case made and can be made that a certain degree of authoritarian rule might be a better guarantor of peace in certain circumstances than democracy itself.
I'm sure that would be provocative. I have two more to my list, but Ambassador Zinsser, you're next.
I thank you very much, Professor Locke, for giving me the floor. Much has been said here about collective security. I think we should stress the importance of principles, and it's because we have been, the world community has been able to elaborate some principle of common recognition that we can think of collective security through the adherence to those principles. And I think the system of collective security is a system in construction. It has been shaped in the charter, but it's not a finished work. It has to be constructed. You have to believe in it and work toward it. And that's why I think global principles are the backbone of collective security and their respect. And global versus regional, I will say not global complementary of regional. Because the system at the charter itself see the regional organizations as complementary to the work of the Security Council. And we have to be able to change the doctrine of security when the process of regional construction is going forward. And I think there is some backlog in the UN security system to that sense, that we have really to recognize the whole potential of regional organizations and use them as such. Africa has been working very thoroughly in this field, and we have also to recognize the fact that this regional construction will affect the legal body of the UN as such. We have developed new norms, for instance, in West Africa that are, so to say, quietly infiltrating the UN system. The concept of responsibility to protect, it was developed in the 70s, 80s by the West African integration process, where we agreed that situations in one country which can affect situations in other country can trigger action without the consent of a government of that precise country. And I am very at ease to push the concept of responsibility to protect here in the United Nations on that basis. That's something that I would like to add to our discussion. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. It does bring to mind this question of necessity as a mother of invention. But it does raise a question, one would think, the history of conflict in Asia. There would have been more invention in terms of international organization, and they found a different path of going about it. Mr. Toro Carnevale, and then Professor Sennett.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I just thank you for the presentations. Very interesting. I just wanted to make a few comments. I wanted to begin by quoting Professors Byers and Chesterman. They say that violation of human rights constitute a great topic of concern, but the solution cannot be to dismantle the international legal system as we know it today. Now, their sovereignty is being attacked by different ways. We have intervention of Kosovo. Recently, we have secession of Kosovo being approved by the International Court of Justice. And we have these new definitions of sovereignty arising all over the place. We have responsibility to protect. We have human security. And we have the concept of weak states. Now, if a state is unable to protect child from being abused, if a state is unable to protect drug trafficking from happening in his country, if a state is unable to protect women from being abused, if it's unable to protect the environment, then it is susceptible of being intervened by other countries. So Ottawa and Mayer, in a paper by the Carnegie Endowment, have said that every low-income country is susceptible of early intervention, and that even middle-income countries are under risk of suffering early intervention if any of their situations becomes dangerous. I'm sorry. So I just want to end with questions. I want to pose this question. If a weak state under these conditions is susceptible of being intervened because it is causing a danger that may spread to other countries, put it from the perspective of a country like Bangladesh or maybe Malawi, whose citizens are suffering from pollution caused in industrialized countries, does Bangladesh have the right to intervene an industrialized country to stop pollution that is causing climate change in his country? So is it just weak states, or could it be strong states also who are susceptible being intervened if their actions are also causing a damaging effect in a different country? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Very well put. Professor Sennett.
That's a very frightening prospect. You mean we'd be invaded by Canada to get us to stop polluting? I just want to make a couple of comments about Kant. One about why I don't think he is going to be much to you, use to you, Mr. Serrano, in thinking about NGOs. And another about why I do think he's quite useful in thinking about practical problems today. Kant, the reason I don't think he's going to help you think about NGOs is that Kant had a very weak notion of civil society, and something very much on his mind. And the notion of intermediation between the citizen and the state was just something that he couldn't, what we think of as intermediate institutions seem to him almost irrelevant to this dialogue, which is primarily between the individual and the sovereign. And that's a blindness in Kant. He was blind to culture in the anthropological sense. And that is something I think you're trying to bring in, the culture of intermediation. On the positive side about Kant, I think you could understand that this isn't just a kind of philosopher's fantasy. If you reverse the order of our meeting today, because for Kant, the idea of a rights-bearing subject, which is what this notion of cosmopolitanism is about, somebody who carries rights within him or herself, wherever they are born, is really the fundamental issue that he's dealing with. And it's he's opened up a door on something he doesn't quite understand. As Michael was saying, he's inspired by the French Revolution, but he doesn't quite know what it means to possess human rights wherever you are. And I mean, the way this works in his theory is that if you are a rights-bearing subject, no matter where you are, the only kind of sovereign which is likely to recognize those is a republic, not a democracy, but a republic. And if there are republics, that is, that recognize the rights of individuals, then the possibility of those republics acting peacefully with each other is great. The proposition is that you have rights as an individual. If you live in a sovereign who doesn't recognize those rights, then nothing follows from that. That's the end of the story. So we've either got things reversed or we're digging down into what is the Kantian logic. And can I just say one thing about the word that's translated in English as hospitality? This has a much huger implication in Kant's writing. It isn't just being nice to foreigners. The notion is that if you are a rights-bearing individual, as a migrant or a political refugee, you have claims on other people, not just claims on their sympathy. But when you arrive there, you have claims to make on them and therefore on their state. And I think if Kant had lived longer and worked this out, this issue of hospitality out more, he would have arrived at something like economic rights of citizenship. That's, in my view, I don't know what you think about this, Michael, but in my view, where this was headed is to understand that not only do people have a right to be welcomed if they're in need, but that those rights are really the rights of self-preservation, prosperity, and so on. And that would be that economic rights are really the foundation, if you trace this all the way out, in my view at least, international economic rights are the foundation of international peace. That's how I'd spin out this theory. And that, it seems to me, is a fairly provocative notion. If you don't have economic rights, then nothing else is going to follow. So I don't know how you... Does that make sense to you?
I'd be happy to react to that. He's living in his own time as a professor, a very talented teacher.
Reacting and changing his views over time. The early Kant is very different from middle Kant, and late Kant is this deep, deep pessimist that we wouldn't almost recognize from Perpetual Peace. So he's a learning, he's engaged in learning continuously. And so the idea that he wouldn't broaden his ideas over time, I think, is perfectly well refuted by his actual history of change, which I think is so impressive. I think it's also the case that, you know, he's been inspiring to generations of philosophers, both at the technical and metaphysical level, but also at the political level. And there are a group of philosophers today whom we call strong cosmopolitans. And I have in mind friends like David Lubin and Henry Shue and others. And they have extended, I think, Kantian ideas in exactly the way that you describe, Richard, to a sense that we have basic rights. And just like we have a right not to be tortured, we have a right not to starve. And that comes back to our colleague, I'm sorry, I don't have my glasses on, so I can't read the name, about the issue of what kind of rights Bangladeshis have in a world where the international community is inflicting indirect harms on them. You know, I think Bob mentioned the 15 or 30 or so feet that the oceans might rise to. That is a catastrophe of, let's call it, nuclear proportions for Bangladesh. And so that raises the most fundamental rights of Bangladeshi citizens to the survival of them as individuals and of their political community. And so it does raise real questions about security, sovereign equality, political independence, territorial integrity in a new meaning to that. And our colleagues like David Lubin and Henry Shue have argued that if someone is starving, let us say, in Haiti, and there is no other resource within Haiti to prevent that starvation, the United States has no right to stop them from landing on the shores of Florida. So that just brings home the radical point that the Kantian foundation of looking at of human respect in the deepest sense of that term and human fulfillment has abilities to evolve over time in ways that are quite radical. And at the same time, there's also a very strong conservative element in it. He is as strong a defender of sovereignty as Hobbes was. He is right with Hobbes on the importance of the state and including, you know, the right and the duty of the state to punish in order to maintain the rule of law. So he's not a soft-minded, what we sometimes think of liberal. He's a pretty hard-thinking rights rule of law theorist. And he thinks, and here's I won't go on longer, is that his idea of perpetual peace among these self-governing sovereign republics is realizable by intelligent devils, by which he means rational interest political scientists. That is, you can come up with material explanations that will take you very, very far to coming to a logical foundation of this understanding of peace, even though he thinks that's what human beings are not about. He thinks that as a matter of right, they have to be rights-bearing and right-respecting individuals. But the material interest of commerce and avoiding war and the educational factor of wars, again, a point that Bob raised, educates people to the importance of peace. As the cost of wars goes up, the likelihood of peace goes up for him. And so he's a very complicated and fascinating philosopher, exactly capable of the kind of let's call it, philosophic evolution that I think you're describing.
I mean, I just add to that what this book is about is removing the, in my view, is removing the domain of thinking about justice and human rights from charity. That is, this is not the domain of something which is a kind of moral goodwill. And that's an enormous break in thinking about what rights are, that rights are rights, not gifts. You know.
Good. Well, thank you. This exchange has had the desired effect. A lot of hands have gone up. And, of course, this meeting follows the natural trajectory. The less time you have, the more people want to speak. So I have four people on my list at the moment, beginning with Pavel de Grief.
Thank you very much. One comment about the usefulness of Kant for NGO's world and also about whether there is a blindness to him about civil society, because it seems to me that that's a bit harsh, blindness compared to whom at the time. There is one great source of possibilities within Kant's work for civil society, which is the continuous emphasis that he places on the importance of publicity. and the public nature of reason, not just the formal condition of the publicity of law in the formalist understanding of the rule of law, but the importance of the public accessibility of reason as a source of impetus for civil society, despite all the ambiguities that were mentioned also, especially concerning the notion of economic rights. In other words, I am much more confident about the immediate usefulness of Kant as a source of support for civil society than as a source of strong arguments in the short run for very strong economic, social, and cultural rights, even at the national level, let alone at the international level.
Great. Next, I have Hans-Jörg Strömeyer, who I assume was stimulated a little bit about what sounded like the beginning of humanitarian and refugee law here in the discussion, Professor Sennett. But.
Thanks, Ed. Yeah, I want to thankful for the comment that you made on charity and humanitarian aid. In fact, I published a few months back an article in one of the major German newspapers exactly about that point, when it was a big debate in Germany about the German public is doing a lot to contribute to the Pakistan floods, you know, but aid is not coming. And was arguing that we really need to, while those the individual responsible behavior is necessary, that alone will not carry what is necessary in a global sense to react to and respond sufficiently and adequately to challenges of climate change and intensifying natural disasters and all the likes that we've seen. So I was very grateful for that, because I do think that if you look at the mere, and Ed and I have talked about this before, if you look at the mere volume, we've been talking a lot about peacekeeping, sort of humanitarian multilateral assistance has been flying a little bit underneath the radar screen, but in fact it's one of the major success stories in a multilateral sense over the last 10 years. Multilateral assistance through consolidated humanitarian appeals have grown from 2003, $2.7 billion, to adjusted for 2009, over $10 billion, quadrupled. And the trends will be our projections that will increase probably over the next 7 to 10 years, despite reluctance on ODA overall, to probably close to $20 billion, just because that's the world we live in. And that brings me to the point that I was going to make. A little bit this the discussion, and I think along the opportunity of long hindsight is nice to see that we have actually made a lot of progress in implementing some of the things that Kant has asked for. But we also have a completely different environment, an environment that is much more transnational than Kant would have probably ever imagined. And that brings me to the right, to the drivers of this responsibility. Is it just rights-conscious citizens, or is it even more rights-conscious states? I would actually argue that we're in the middle of a debate right now where some argue the human rights conscious and ready to fight for human rights states or alliances of states actually toning down considerably on human rights for other values such as trade, the absence of war, which is not the same as achievement of peace, as we know, economic interests and so on, which may come to haunt us in over the next 30 to 50 years in terms of human rights and humanitarian objectives. So for me, if we need to be conscious that some of the drivers of these responses have in fact not been responsible states, they have reacted to impetuses that have been set by the media, for example, by a 24-hour news cycle that in our mundane as that may seem, that in our world, the humanitarian world that I just described as this rather multilaterally over $10 billion strong, stronger than peacekeeping in effect, industry, that is one of the major drivers. We cannot afford today anymore. I know I have a mobile where within 8 seconds I know where there is an earthquake or a disaster. It just comes electronically. We need to react to very different disasters today than we would have even 5 years ago. I said to one of your ambassadorial colleagues the other day who said we need a paradigm shift. I said, I think we're in the middle of a paradigm shift. 5 years ago in New York, you would have not had three ambassadors who would have hosted a roundtable or a luncheon over improving response capacity to natural disasters. Now, natural disaster is as big, if not in some instances bigger, in all its dimensions, security as much as the human aspect of it, than some of our peace and security discussions that we're having in war and conflict. But we need to realize, I think, that the drivers for this have not only been responsible or more responsible states or human rights conscious, humanitarian conscious states or regional organizations also, but it is that our world overall has changed with the news cycle, with what Chef Foreman said before. I think transnational movements and their impact on parliaments and public opinion and public perceptions that we haven't really explored yet. And I think there is an important impact on both the sovereignty notion as well as the state responsibility notion. I just wanted to suggest that we need to explore that really a little further to understand really what are the drivers, the good, but also the dangerous drivers of those kinds of interventions. Thank you.
Now, well put. I think it put the question of values and interests and their relationship very, very nicely there. Adam, next.
If I could take a moment and bring it back to a couple of distinctions made by the speakers, trying to make a very brief comment. And this is the distinction between collective security defined as a willingness to intervene for your friends regardless of self-interest versus common security based on common interest. And then the difference between the League of Like-Minded States, which you sort of see in Kant, and then what we have at the UN, which is a universal institution of sovereign states with sometimes competing interests. And I think, obviously, what we have is, I think, convinced by Professor Jervis that we don't actually have something like collective security as it's defined in its pure sense. But we do have, especially in the European Union, this sense of common security based on the development of common interests. And then at the UN, we have the last point, the universal institution of sovereign states. And I think that this type of system contains different types of demands than that you see in Kant. And I would state those as very simply the need to develop common interests. And I think in a time of economic globalization, this becomes the economic sphere is very important. I think that's where the EU is as was stated, the example par excellence. But then there's the need to develop universal norms that remain compatible with the principle of the sovereign equality of states. And I think we'll get a little bit more talking about this in the afternoon. But I would say just in support of my colleague and boss that I think R2P really satisfies that condition.
Thanks very much. Gudrun Hara.
Thank you very much. I have a short question. It's a historical question. But first, let me say that I was suffering and looking forward a little bit to the afternoon, suffering because you were very much already in my panel, which I chair in the afternoon. But
Sorry about that.
I said I'm looking forward to it even more because I see it will be a very interesting discussion. My historical question, I think to Mr. Doyle, isn't it the case that Kant wrote this piece also after the conclusion of the French-Prussian separate peace? I don't remember the title of the treaty. And it meant also, okay, Kant liked the French Revolution as it was in the first moment, but didn't it mean also that it was a document which supported the idea of non-interference. I mean, it was a little bit directed, I think, against the Austrian interests. Huh? So what do we conclude from that? Non-interference responsibility, where does it lead us? I mean, in the Kantian thinking, when he takes distance from the revolution, does he change his mind? I mean, what perhaps you can tell me something about it. I really don't know.
I'd suggest we let Elazar Barkin make his comments, and then Professor. I just promoted you from ambassador to professor, and then Ambassador Galvez, and then why don't you make a concluding comment along with...
Thank you. Well, I do have some questions for professors, rather than, like, I'm not a professor. But just, I would like to say a few words on Latin America.
Please.
And first, why we have some kind of peace now? I think it's not because we have a league or, you know, an integration process. It's rather because we have what Kant called republics, I mean, democracies. And the first question is, you know, in the 60s or 70s, you have military government, and it was quite complicated. But today, it is clear to me that this is what we have. And the question is, in what sense Kant has the word republic? In what sense is different from democracy today? What it means is liberal democracy? That was the meaning? But anyway, normally we will start thinking that he was using the word republic for democracies, and this is what we have. But I can feel that illiberal democracies can be also a problem. It can be very ideological and can just create problems in other countries. And I think in our region we can see that in some way, that, you know, if you provide your territory for doing things in another, of course you create a problem. But that is a question, and I don't have clarity. But I feel that republics mean, in Kant, liberal democracies. The second thing is that peace is also related, I will say, rather than leagues, the question of security communities. I think security communities are very important. I can't imagine now a war between Brazil and Argentina, neither between Chile and Argentina. It just because, I mean, I can't think it in any possibility, but in the past, maybe 30 years ago, it was different. And we thought this with relation to the NPT. I remember when I studied at the Diplomatic Academy, we were not assigned it in the NPT, nor Argentina, nor Brazil. But once one started doing that, everyone felt that it was kind of ridiculous to think in nuclear arms. And you are not spending, you know, some kind of the resources you don't have in nuclear power. And on the question of integration, I will say the OAS has the democratic charter. It is a very good idea. At least, even if it's not working perfectly, at least you have as a goal that whatever, sometime people will support each other in terms of democracy. But it's a risky thing because, as someone said, it's only the small countries who are being intervened always. It's just wrong. I have nothing wrong if you intervene for, I mean, very valid reason in another country. I mean, I don't sort of, and even if those are the small, lucky the small, because that means that those people will be defended. But it is clear to me that you will never intervene a big country. I mean, even if anything could happen there. And the third is just only a question. Also, I was a little bit struck with the question of what is the meaning of collective security? And someone said there is no, even if it was not clear to me why NATO can be said as a collective security. For me, it's a defense alliance. I mean, it's different. In the sense, maybe you can have the word collective security, but in reality, you're going to defend each other if you're going to have a threat to your peace. The collective security, only I can imagine right now, is at the UN, where you're saying if there is an aggression, whoever is going to be agreed, I mean, at least you're saying in writing that you're going to do something. Maybe you're not going to do it because it's not going to be in your interest, but in a more theoretical way, I suppose that collective security is that everyone will go in defense of those who is invaded or who has suffered aggression without regarding on your own national interests. And maybe it's just an idea, but sometimes it's good to keep ideas up there as a goal, but it is very complicated when you start confusing names and things that are not collective security, while you can write it collective security, but it is better we have to clarify when it's a defense alliance, a very good one, a very necessary one, but I don't think it is there to defend aggression in very hard part of the world that is not related to those who are member there. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. I maybe when you're responding to some of these questions about collective security, Bob. Can you have collective security in a pure sense if the body that makes the decision has to vote on whether to respond or not? I mean, I can't think of one that doesn't, whether it's a Security Council, whether it's NATO, whether it's EU, whatever. It doesn't fit your pure definition of sort of automatic obligation. I would just say there have been several comments about sovereignty in small states. It's worth remembering that John Bolton was very negative and remains very negative in Responsibility to Protect and a lot of other things because he thinks it imposes an obligation to respond and therefore compromises the decision-making of a large state. So that large states get compromised in one way in terms of sovereignty, small states in a territorial sense get compromised in a very more direct way. And we haven't forgotten you, Elazar. So Elazar, and then Ambassador Zinzo, and then we'll go to our three final respondents. So Elazar, please.
Thank you. Perhaps just a couple of comments about the conversations on the issues of the relationship of theory to practice. And I think that one of the issues that is raised is obviously when we talk about there is the historical interest in Kant, and obviously that can inform us at the abstract level. But in the concrete, there is obviously the dissonance that we just mentioned about the distinction between the right or between the possibility and the obligation. And clearly, there is nothing in it that actually talks us about the obligations and the questions of the reciprocity between someone having a right and some or group has having a right and the obligations of someone else rather than others in the world to respond to it. The other thing that perhaps we should need to pay more attention to today when we read Kant historically or from a contemporary perspective is the questions of plurality and the notion that in an ideal world we will all reach a similar conclusion seems theoretically thin, not just practically impossible. And I think that we must include that into the considerations because the idea that for some reason, we would all agree on an analysis of a situation in a similar way is so inconceivable to us that it's not just that it doesn't happen, it's just not something we can imagine. And I think this is very critical for an analysis of the implications of those aspirations to contemporary discussion.
Very good. And it raises the question whether it's more difficult to get a consensus in a faculty committee or in the Security Council. I think it's faculty committee is the ultimate. But Ambassador Zinzo.
I thank you very much, Professor Love, for giving me the floor a second time again. I would like to come back on the issue of intervention in small states. It's the issue of intervention in small states. It's all about the capacity to act at a precise moment, and usually what fails in the small states is the capacity to act. That's why the issue is addressed in terms of acting, action by the international community. But as regarding the powerful states which are disregarding universal laws, the system has built-in mechanism to make the cost of this disregard expensive for them and motivate them to come back on the right track. So we have really to use the dynamic and not to oppose concepts each other for the sake of equality of so to say application of the concepts. Situations require specific approaches, and I think that we have to enforce, we have to strengthen the capacity of a system to make the disregard of law, of universal law, expensive for powerful states. I thank you.
Great, thanks very much. Michael, I don't know if you wanted to respond to any of the questions about history and context, and then Pedro, and then Bob. Is there anything you wanted to respond to?
Yes, briefly, yeah, indeed, you know, Kant was writing in the context of the quasi-Prussian-French agreement at the time. I don't think that has anything to do with his theory. I think it's ordinary balance of power politics where Prussia was attempting to reduce the influence of Austria, regarded this as a good opportunity to do so. But it was part of the context that, you know, previously he had been protected by Frederick the Great, so he had some affiliation with the government. But at the time that he's writing now, he'd been abandoned. And so the Frederick Wilhelm, for example, condemned him specifically. I did the Minister of Education. There was a new pietist movement. It's a sad notion for academics that you can have a very successful career, and at the very end, all of the young people are becoming nationalists, Fichte and Herder and others, and the state turns against you, and it's really very tough. So he ended on a grim note, and I think that would be a point there. On liberal democracies, that's sort of what he is getting at. That is, there's a rights notion that's embedded within the concept of his republic. But he's very strongly committed to the idea of the rule of law as a constraint on democratic majority tyranny, to checks and balances, to all of the constraints on democratic factionalism, emotionalism, arrogance, all of the concerns that he saw through history. And he was hoping to find constitutional ways to deal with that. But he acknowledged repeatedly that it's not always going to work. And he often condemns states that he sees that are quasi, if you will, Republican, engaging in great harms, including imperialism. He has a very strong criticism of commercially based imperialism in the document.
Terrific, Pedro.
Thank you very much. No, very interesting exchange. Certainly, I do believe that sovereignty requires, it has been analyzed very much, was analyzed already by Kant, but certainly I think we see there the power of a word. Probably different states right now have a different concept of what their sovereignty is. And I was also wondering, when I was listening to the discussion, you know, do we have an equivalent thing for sovereignty at a macro level? We talk about global governance. That's not very powerful, is it? How will all this interact? Certainly, sovereignty has changed from Kant's time to our time. Certainly, within our time, there are different concepts of sovereignty. Certainly, as we've been seeing, other actors within societies and in a transnational way have important responsibilities in the way the world evolves. And we don't have, I think maybe we do, since I'm a poor practitioner, maybe I'm not as aware, but how to handle all these different actors. Certainly you're attacking it from the, let's say, protection of the defenseless. We talk about protection of civilian. We talk about human security. This is to protect those that don't have a voice, really, in a way. And how much can we be, sovereign nations, ready to sacrifice these powers in that? Well, it certainly varies. Then I think we obviously got involved. Well, we were talking about Kant, and of course we got involved in sort of an idealist controversy about moral values and their translation into norms. And, you know, I'm always wondering, of course, what is the link then to reality? And I think values are very important, norms as well, but we will not get to values and then to norms if we don't have the common interests. And I think that's very much what we try to do across the road, trying to find these common interests and to move afterwards into values and norms. Thank you.
Terrific. Bob, you get the last word.
Well, I'm conscious of I'm the person standing between you and coffee break, so I will be very, very brief. I think one point that's come out really quite in one question is, you know, how are there necessary preconditions for achieving peace, not in the world, but between two countries and a region? And my sense is that there may be, but there isn't one golden rule. That is, there can be multiple paths for achieving the common and desired end. And Mr. Galvez made the very good point that there is a security community among countries in South America that is a radical change from even 20, 25 years ago. The path they followed has some overlap with the European path, with the path that the U.S. and other countries follow, but is not identical. And that, I think, is really a very hopeful sign. It means that we, in order to establish peace in between other countries and other regions, there may be ways, and these countries may not, and areas may not meet the preconditions either that Kant would have expected or that some of our social science theories would lead us to expect, but they can get there anyway. And I think that is extremely interesting. I think there is a tremendous variety in the world. Sometimes that comes and surprises us in unpleasant ways, but it can mean there are also many ways to desired ends. Just the final thing, you know, we've talked a little about how much common values or moral sense, and I just want to note something. Many of you probably know this, but at least again, the academic world, for a long period after really World War II, consideration of human nature sort of dropped out, or when it was there, it was consideration of evil in there. But it's interesting that in the last 20 years of biology and neuroscience, there's been much more interest in really inborn moral sense. And that research indicates quite strongly not that people automatically will do good, but actually through the development of our brain, probably really through the processes of evolution, there is a much more, if you will, bias toward goodness than we'd often thought. And this, of course, does not mean people always do good. We've always seen our recent and current history. But again, when you think of grounds for possibilities, it really is striking the degree to which our brains are hardwired to for some forms of hospitality, narrow and broad. Thank you.
Oh, a very good way to end. Thank you. We ran over, I guess, 6 or 7 minutes. I'm sorry, Professor Banks, who is moderating the next session, that we've transgressed a little bit and transgressed on the topics for this afternoon as well. But I think it's a very rich discussion, and we'll take a 15-minute coffee break. I was told 10 minutes ago that there was fresh coffee outside in the hall. I assume it's still fresh. And thank you to our two presenters.